quite sure that this is been recording lately. So here we are. Erica, you should arrange your seat so you can see. You're not craning your neck at all. I've been doing a bit of talking lately about commitment and vows, intentions, all of these concepts that are about choices that we make in our lives, and then take steps to actualize those choices. And each of them have the quality of needing to be maintained. So it's not like you just press the button and, you know, vow is done and you're done. They actually require not only the startup effort, but then the maintenance. And in order to maintain our vows, our intentions, our commitments, we actually have to take the time to reflect on them, to periodically reflect and revisit the vows and intentions and commitments that we've made. And we do that because as we get into our day-to-day lives, it's pretty easy to let a vow or an intention that we made at some other point slip off of the to-do list. Everything is moving fairly quickly, and there seems to be a lot to do. And we are not all living in, even living in community. We're not living in the kind of container that says, well, all there is to do is to maintain these vows. All there is to do is to maintain these intentions. Really, the monks and nuns have it easy because the setup for them is that that's all there is to do, and everything you do falls into that. Is that possible for people that are living in the world? Is it possible? Or do we always have to choose on an ongoing basis between keeping our intentions, maintaining those intentions, or living our lives, quote unquote? Are we always going to be in the dance? In the tension between I have this commitment that I've made, and there's also my life, my real life. And I've got to move back and forth, right? Is that the general sense that we have when we negotiate our relationship to these vows and intentions? Or is there a possibility that is different? Is there a possibility of allowing, in fact, setting up the situation in our lives so that those vows, our intentions, our commitments become the guide path by which we live our lives, and thus everything falls into the framework of those vows and intentions? Most often, it seems to me, we get stuck in the first idea that what we're doing is making choices between opposing forces. That on the one hand, we want to live these lives of service, and we want to have practice in order to bring a clear view of how to do that, and how to do that in a good way, into clarity for ourselves. But on the other hand, we want to have relationships, and we want to go out and party, and we want to have fun in the whole big general sense of the word, which could be the beach, or for me it's a hammock, or anywhere at all, really. But all of the list of things, and then there's the store to go to, the groceries to buy, there's the chores to do, the bathrooms to clean, there's the regular, everyday life stuff also. And then there are these rather disconcerting elements called people that we also have to negotiate into this whole scheme. And this room is getting pretty crowded here. We got vows and tensions and commitments. We have play. We have love. We have work. We have chores. Category all their own. And then we have people. People. Not even just the people that we choose. Random people. Random people. Into every day. How do we make sense of this? How do we find our way to removing the perception of friction as in a kind of negative friction? Oppositional tension from this balance, from this walk we try to walk. How do we lay the path with the bricks of our intention and of our vows and have our lives roll out on that path? Require in ourselves, because what's out there is just material, really. What is required in ourselves in order to have the skill to do this, to essentially be a bricklayer of the path of your own life. To be able to choose the bricks that you want to choose and have that be the solid ground that you walk on. It's always a question for you. Even when there's no question mark on it. To begin with, it might have something to do with assuring that the stones that you choose, the bricks that you choose, are solid ones. Not the new thin versions that they have that crumble, that are just for appearances, you know? They used to make houses with bricks, and now they have this brick face that is maybe about a tenth as thin as real brick. And it's just there to give the appearance of that solidity that we see. We recognize and we feel when we see a brick house built. We want to make sure that the path that we are creating for ourselves is not just in appearances, that it's not laid in such a way that our vows are not formed and related to in such a way that it's just a veneer, that it's just a thin layer that's really hiding a much less solid underbelly. Because our vows, that's our foundation. That's what everything else is going to rest upon. And if we hold them, if we relate to them in such a way that they're just a veneer, just brick face, eventually, probably sooner than later, the storm that comes will just rip that brick face off and expose the shabby underside for what it is. So it's really important that we choose strong foundation, vows that we can really settle into, that are not, if you know anything about bricks, like not, you don't have to know, you know, you've seen it, not crumbly, right? Not too dry, right? Because if they're too dry, they'll just crumble when anyone taps on them. If they're got too much moisture, then there's no way for them to hold and be solid. When it rains, they'll just wash away. So you need just the right kind of consistency. Feels right to you. In terms of actual vows, vows that feel like you can connect to them. That when you read them, when you say the words, that you feel the ground forming beneath you. And if you don't have that, there's no way to maintain. If you have kind of empty, hollow brick, there's no way to maintain. If you're just mouthing the words of vows, beings are numberless, I vow to awaken them. If you're not fully planting your feet on the solid ground of that foundation and allowing yourself to root on your path, there's nothing to be unfolded in front of you, nothing for you to rest your life on. And vows are alive. They're dynamic, they're to be played with, right? In the sense that if they become too rigid, then that also gives a brittleness to the situation. So once the vows are chosen and laid for you, you lay them out, if there's no give, there's no space between them, if they're all pressed up against each other in a way that doesn't allow for breathing and growth, you know, when all types of paths are laid, they realize that actually you can't lay it as tight as you might think you want to. You actually have to build in some space for breathing, because everything that's alive breathes. Everything that's alive breathes and needs space in order to breathe. And in fact, needs space to expand and to contract, because this is the ebb and flow of our lives. And if we don't build that in terms of how we view our vows. If we don't build in some space in the way that we view them that allows for the contraction and expansion, then it gets too tight and it just crumbles beneath our feet. And we thought, oh, those were very good vows. So there's some work to do, right? It's not just about mumbling some words. Even if you mumble them every day, even if you mumble them loud, there's some work to do in terms of how you view them. That you have to have, to begin with, a good motivation for having these vows to begin with. That your motivation is clear. As clear as it can be. And then you have to have the right attitude in terms of how you relate. So there's the motivation, and generally, when we first arrive at practice, we actually don't have any good motivation. We have thin motivation, often motivation that's coming from our own wanting to save ourselves or wanting to look kind of cool or wanting to add another thing to our list of accomplishments. And our motivation needs to be strengthened in a particular way, which usually has something to do with us getting beyond the place in which we're fascinated with our own practice. Fascinated like it's a toy. Fascinated like it's something to be shown off. Fascinated by something to be taken out and played with when we feel like it. And quickly set aside when the mood doesn't strike us. Only when we pass through that kind of relationship with practice and it just becomes ordinary. Are we really capable of recognizing and having the appropriate motivation for really stepping on a path? We're essentially good. Really, we are fundamentally good. We have obscurations. We have things that get in our way, that disable our ability to see what the source is, what the motivation is for the choices that we make. The very first realm of our practice is actually to clarify our motivation. The way that we establish a path here in the Dharma is to kind of scoot you out there and leave you to flail around a bit and find out if, with your first push in the water, you want to come back on the boat and be safe and secure. Because if you do, you're not going to be able to weather that path well. If you expect that when you step out on a path that someone's always going to be there to have their hand out, fixing things for you, making it comfortable, making sure that you know everything that's going to happen, making sure that you're secure in that old way that we like to be secure, where we know everything, we know what's coming, it's all laid out. What's the next step? When does this happen? How long does that take? We feel sure of ourselves then. And I'm just guessing, just imagining that if it were that simple, there'd be a whole bunch of folks that have tread the path and crossed over to the other shore. So we have to be prepared through our motivation for the not knowing that is inherent to walking on any path of discovery. Because that's what it is. It's a path of not knowing, it's not a path of knowing, it is a path of discovery. And if you have all the answers, if the route is all laid out for you, you have 511 to call and make sure the traffic is clear up ahead, you know where your pocket is full of money and you're going to be able to eat at all the stops along the way, eat just what you want to eat when you want to. At least if you have that view of your path, there's no discovery. Not to say there's nothing to be discovered. There's plenty to be discovered, but you won't be able to discover what's there. This isn't specific to each of you. It's common to most everyone. Life basically knocks the wind out of us. We reach out for some kind of help. We get some signal and some potential for help. And then we proceed with the same behavior that got the wind knocked out of us to begin with. And we think that this is workable. Most of us suffer from trying to get our practice to fit into our lives. We suffer from trying to get our practice to fit into our lives. And all of the shuffling and fighting and cajoling that comes with it. Anybody getting the picture here? Your practice will never fit into your life. It can only be your life. Otherwise, it's just a hobby. It's just another task. It's just another to-do. It's another appointment. Whatever it is that your practice is, we happen to sit and do asana practice here. We happen to breathe. But whatever it is, if prayer is your practice, and you squeeze it in on Sundays, then it's just another appointment. And don't get me wrong, people go and keep their appointments for their entire lives. Just like people go and keep appointments with therapists for their entire lives. But the fruit, it's got no juice when we have that kind of relationship. There's a saying that whatever way in which you view your practice is actually what you're going to get out of it. There, they specifically talk about whatever way you view your teacher is what you're going to get out of them. So if you're fixated on, yeah, my teacher's, you know, really very human, then you're going to get a human experience of your practice. But if you have the view, say that word one more time, the view of your teacher as Buddha, as an embodiment of Buddha, then you're going to get a Buddha out of your practice. And it's the same way of your practice itself. If your practice is just something that you fit into your life, well, you're just going to get another appointment, another task fulfilled. And you'll get all of the experience of, got my task filled, did it. But if you hold your practice in a way that in which you understand that your practice is your life, as you meet your practice, you meet your whole life. And you meet everything in it. And the struggle, the opposition between your life and your practice falls away. Obviously, that's just not for everyone. It just isn't. And you know, when I say this, I don't mean to suggest you've got to be special. But you do have to be different. You have to be making different choices. In fact, you can be really stupid and make practice your life. In fact, it's easier for those of us that are stupid, because we don't complicate the situation with all kinds of ideas. Those of us that are enamored with ourselves and our thinking complicate things. And then we applaud ourselves for complicating things. We spend all of our time figuring out basically how we can resist our practice. And then we spend time wondering about why we resist our practice. And then we spend more time having conversations with other people about what they think about us resisting our practice, instead of just choosing to be in our lives. And allowing everything that arises in our life to be folded into practice, to be understood as practice. And this is what is considered having the right attitude. So at the beginning of approaching a path, the first order of business is to just have it clarified, to have your motivation clarified by engaging a path at all. But it doesn't mean you're just on a path. We trick ourselves. We, you know, people run around and meet somebody one time and they're like, I have a teacher, I'm on a path. Well, how do you know? Because you don't even have the view to understand where you are. First job of the path is to actually to help you clarify if you have the motivation to really be here. And then once you're there, it is up to you to cultivate the attitude to maintain it. And that goes for your commitments and your intentions as well. And if there's something getting in your way, does anybody have anything not getting, nothing, there's nothing in your way? Yeah. If there's something getting in your way, it's your job to discover it. To be willing to do the very, very challenging work of looking at what it is that's getting in your way. I don't mean to have sessions about it. I don't mean to go and, you know, make a case out of it. I mean to look. I mean to look into it. What is it in you that keeps you from your commitments? What is it that is unhealed within yourself that keeps you from living the life that you choose? What is it that you have to bring your full attention to before you can really have the right attitude for keeping your vows, maintaining them, for meeting your intentions, for honoring your commitments? I would say that discovering this and then meeting it, I mean, not fixing it, meeting it, being in relationship with it, is probably about 75% of the job. Maybe 80%. The job of being on a path. After that, it's just a cakewalk, really. And most of us spend a great deal of our time trying to avoid whatever that is and hope that we'll bear fruit somehow despite that. Not going to happen. Whatever it is that is unhealed in you, whatever it is that keeps your heart closed, whatever it is that keeps your sight blurred, is hindering you from your own freedom. And freedom will not be had despite that thing. It will only be had because of your willingness to move it. And it is a gift when we can see what it is. As hard as it might be to look at, it is a gift. Truly a gift when we can see what it is. And it's truly an act of courage when we step up every single day, every single moment, to meet it. Hear what I'm saying? That we step up to meet it. Not we wait for it to sneak up behind us and whack us in the back of the head. Not we wait for it to slide into the conversation and slip out of our mouths. Not we wait for it to trip us up just when we got to really take off and run really fast. that we make the choice to go and meet it. Is an act of fearlessness that is itself freedom. It's getting a little hot in here. Because we all know. Can you hear the part of yourself that's making excuses? Very familiar, well, the part of you that wants to argue, that wants to say, well, that's not, you know, I don't really have to. Well, what about? That voice is never, ever the voice of freedom. Ever. It is only our ego that is interested in picking things apart, in, you know, can't we get it a little bit to the left? It shouldn't quite be that way. And if, on the other hand, you hear the voice that probably doesn't even have words, that's just a soft, and that's the voice you should be listening for, and you should pull your ear close to, because it has something to say. And really, there's so much out there to amuse us and distract us away from that unhealed place, to instead have us busy ourselves doing all the things that we busy ourselves with, sometimes including meditation and yoga. We don't get to it. We're just holding it off longer and longer, holding off our own liberation. If we don't drop our ideas about fixing it, we're holding off our liberation. We just have to meet it. We just have to meet that knot in the pit of our bellies and bear witness to it until it softens under the sweetness, really, of our gaze. Until it unknots itself because of our willingness to bring attention to it. Once it begins to do that, maybe we can help it along. But first, we just have to be there. Like any relationship that we need to bring resolution. We just have to be there. that means that maybe I don't need to be.